A little higher. That's very good. This morning we're using a text from one of the Psalms of David, and I suspect it has not been interpreted very often as we wish to approach it, because very often these very old ideas have some eternal truths behind them. The idea in this particular verse is that David sings that the earth belongs to the Lord and the fullness thereof. Now, this does something we had not really given much attention to, but it's tremendously true. What David is telling us is that God is a landlord. Now, we've accused him of many things, but not that generally. But it is true. The only owner there is anywhere in the material universe is the creating power itself. It is the deity that becomes, in a sense, the source of all of the labors of peoples. Now, if God is the landlord, then humanity, made up of all races and nations, are all tenants. Now, we know down here in our little human community that there are many difficulties between landlords and tenants. They don't get along too well together. The tendency, of course, of the landlord is to resent the fact that the tenant lets his property go to pieces. Well, God might have the same feeling concerning our use of this wonderful world that was given to us. We're not taking proper care of it. We're not good tenants. We just do as we please, and when it gets impossible, we try to move out. On the other hand, the tenant has certain grudges and grievances. He likes to believe that he is being imposed upon, that whenever he asks anything, it's not given to him, or if it is, it's done grudgingly. And there is really very little understanding between the two great groups. The first group consisting of one only, God, and the second group consisting of everyone else. Now, the actual truth of the matter is that no matter how we look at it, we are all tenants. There is not anything in this world that the human being can actually own. Now, we have nations that are fighting for the fatherland. We have one country trying to take over the territories of another. We find all kinds of exploitations going on around us in the world, even in our own communities. But behind it all is the inevitable fact that we do not own anything. We can have things. We buy them from some local real estate agent who is selling us something he doesn't own. And if we go back far enough to the original deed, it goes back to heaven. Actually, only thing that any of us can have is a lease, a lend lease on the things that to us are important. We can borrow a good home and live in it for a lifetime, but we cannot own it permanently because we have to leave it. So it goes to someone else. All we have actually bought is a lease for a lifetime. And that is all we buy on anything in this world. Now, we try to extend this lease a little by deeding the things to our descendants. This is only, however, putting off the matter temporarily. They are in the same condition. And all over the world, families are dying out completely, and the properties go to strangers. We have all kinds of things we enjoy in this world. We enjoy great art. There's been quite a deal in the papers recently of some very expensive art. Then we find that these wealthy people create museums and deed the art to the public. This is all they can do with it anyway. Because actually, no one can own anything except for his own lifetime. And this is usually not too long a span, because the larger donors do not reach that the ability to don until they're well and long in middle life. So here we are in a world in which we are becoming increasingly selfish. We are constantly striving to take over something. Pitcairn Island, with less than 200 inhabitants, has an idea that it would like to be a free and independent nation. Vatican City, with measuring only in acreage, is a municipal entity. And then something else that owns half the world, like China, believes it is here forever. But whether China is half the planet, or how old it is, the planet is not Chinese. The whole deal must ultimately return to the big landlord. Now, the big landlord is equipped with certain rules. He is perfectly willing to permit tenancy with reasonable restrictions. These reasonable restrictions do not permit vandalism. They do not permit or advocate the exhaustion of natural resources, nor do they support the concept of waste. Actually, everything that is on this planet is to us by loan. Our natural resources belong ultimately to the Lord, and the remains and revenues thereof. But we don't think about this very much. Everything we can get our hands on is for us. Now, this great sense of possession leads us to wonder what we can possess. We can't possess the trees or the earth or the sky. We can't possess the air. We can pollute it, but we can't possess it. We can do all kinds of unpleasant things to detract from the beauty, joy, and healthfulness of our environment. But we cannot own the environment. We can only use it or misuse it. And in the world today, environments are mostly misused. As we think all these matters over, it would seem that one of the great foundations of our problems is this desperate desire to accumulate. We want more than the neighbor. We want enough to protect ourselves and our descendants. We have all kinds of ideas of how we can own things. And instead of recognizing that this ownership is at most only the position of custodian, we get too much involved in the ideas of profit, which is itself a fallacy, and get away from the natural integrities by which this planet could be well regulated and those dwelling together could enjoy the privileges and benefits of a very benevolent and very understanding landlord. Now, we have this given to us, this world in which we live, in order that we may grow, increase in grace, become more aware of the wonders of nature. We want to enjoy the privileges of learning, and out of it all, we want to grow. And the great byproduct of life is growth. And where growth doesn't occur, life is wasted. So this great environment that has been given to us, this wonderful world which is on lease to us, is actually the great sphere of environmental growth. The only thing we can take with us when we leave is the experience that we have gained. It's exactly like a child going to school. When he graduates from school, he cannot take the school with him, but he takes with him what he has learned in the school. When we depart from this world, we cannot take the worldliness with us. We cannot take the things we own, The Chinese tried to bury the images of their kings and emperors and their whole courts of the earth, so that in the afterlife, the great ones could enjoy the company of the things of the physical life that they had enjoyed. Actually, however, we know that this was simply a gesture, that the clay and porcelain and ivory and jade figures did not live or come to life to serve the deceased monarchs. Therefore, actually, we could simplify life tremendously if we got out of our heads some of the mistaken ideas that have been troubling us for so very long a time. We could get out of the mistaken notion that wealth is something that is permanent, and that a wealthy person is one who has actually control over the destiny of his possessions. This is not true. He can will them as he wants to, and half the time the will be broken. He can do all he wishes to do. He can even ask to have his worldly goods buried with him. But if he does, he might merely put it in a casket where it remains until it rots away or is discovered by someone else, who then gains possession for a time. The idea of permanent possession, permanent estate, and the glories of mortal life, all these ideas are fallacies. We are not here to increase in the worldly aspects or to find ways of becoming leaders over other people. What we are trying desperately to do, if we know it or not, is we are trying to learn how to live. We are trying to learn how to mingle together in a companionship of ethics. We are here to serve with each other and to make the marvelous discoveries of the latent potentials locked in those around us. Therefore, actually, this is merely a classroom at best. It is a place which is used to study in. But most people aren't studying in it anymore. They're not much interested in study. What they really want now is to change this earth into a playground. They want to make it one vast enjoyment. But somehow, they don't seem to work it quite that way. Instead of being happier every day, they are more fear-ridden every day. And these fears and anxieties are gentle reminders from the big landlord that we are abusing our properties. We are not doing what we should be doing. If we were, there would be no worry, no fear, and very little debt. It is because we are irrational in our methods of doing things that we forget entirely the ethics of existence and the morality of relationships, and go on trying to make our little pile somewhere to gain that extra money that will give us the yacht and the summer home in the islands. And yet, the next year, when we go, that home will pass to someone else, and unless we are very fortunate, we may have to sell the yacht before we die. All of this is dealing in transient, inconsequential things. Almost all of our possessiveness comes under the general the general statement of the bad habit. Possessiveness is a bad habit. It is an attitude towards things that is unhealthy. It is the source of most crime. It is the source of most poverty. And the unequal distribution of values has got the whole world perturbed at the present time. We do not know what to do next. We do not know how to cope with the gradual exhaustion of natural resources. We do not know how to settle the endless feuds between countries. And we do not know how to arbitrate the gangsterism in our own country. All of these things are because of a basic fallacy upon which we have built since the beginning of history. We have always been desirous of conquering something. We want to rise competitively above our associates. We want to have more than the next person. There's been no question about what to do with what we have. And very often after we get it, it is nothing but a misery. But the great adventure is to get it. And in doing this, we are unbalancing the whole economy of nature. Because there's no way, actually, for the earth to produce the final world conqueror. The only great conquest possible is the individual conquering himself. Many, many dictators have arisen trying to capture the earth. All they finally got was 6 square feet of it. They have no way of overcoming or balancing the inevitable laws of life. Even if we extend living for another 10 or 15 years, in the end, the property returns to the original owner, and there's nothing we can do to prevent it. And if we try to will it to somebody else, it merely puts off the evil time. But when they pass, they must do the same, and ultimately, it will return to nature itself. But it may return very tired, badly exploited. It may not be the beautiful earth they started out with, but a crumbling planet being destroyed by the ruthlessness of human beings themselves. Actually, we have to try to reconstruct life. One thing that was pointed out, I think, by the philosophers of the Elizabethan period in England, that was pointed out very clearly that the values that are interesting, important, significant, useful, are not competitive. That there is nothing in all the world that we need to cheat each other about. Actually, the proper integrity would result in all persons having their proper place in a simple, natural, and direct plan of existence. It is not necessary for poverty to exist, but poverty must exist while competition exists. There is no reason why an autocracy or a dictatorship should plague civilization. A dictator is only someone who believes he can run the world, when in reality, even as he believes this, he is fading away himself. So in this idea of the world belonging to the original landlord, I think we have the grounds for considerable reflection. We can begin to estimate what we can do to restore the property. When we sign the lease, symbolically, we agree to return the property to the original owner in good condition. We agree to take care of keeping it clean. We are willing to make such necessary repairs as have been caused by our own tenancy. Therefore, actually, the idea is that the original owner is entitled to receive back the property in the same quality of condition that he leased it in the first place. Well, if anyone should return the planet at this moment to the original landlord, it would be a very terrible misery. It would be necessary to completely reconstruct, reorganize, re-edit, and renovate the shattered fabric that comes back. We are ruining the planet, even though we do not own it. We are ruining somebody else's property. We are damaging natural resources that can affect generations as yet unborn. And we keep right on doing it. We have no intentions of interfering with business as usual. And when this business becomes impossible and we gather onto ourselves a depression, then we all feel that the landlord is to blame. Things have not worked out, and of course, we could never be wrong. As atheism increased and became more prevalent in this country and in the world, the idea of the big landlord sort of faded out entirely, and it was finally decided that the planet was a small island in space in which a large number of living things were marooned together in a hopeless situation. There was nothing to look forward to except trying to do the best we could with this small ball on which we live. Atheism gave no superior factors to strengthen us. There were no inducements to improvement because, as far as atheism was concerned, the planet and all that it inhabits will fade to nothing in due time. So having no future, the materialist tries to compensate by a reckless present behavior. He will live it all up now, because now is the only time. But actually, living it up now is the greatest waste of time that there is. We have much more important considerations. Now, as we look over the world affairs, as they seem to be at the moment, we realize a gradually increasing realization that things are wrong. We are beginning to realize also that these mistakes are not divine injustices. It is not heaven that has decreed that we have a depression. It is not the divine powers of space that send one nation after another in war. These things are our own misconducts. They are the things that we do that we shouldn't do. And somewhere along the line, the answer to the whole problem is to reorganize our own concepts toward reality. Because if we continue the reckless wasting of our resources, we could end up a dead planet incapable of sustaining life. If that is the case, the big landlord would probably have to tear it down and build a new one. His apartments and condominiums cannot be repaired. So we have to either begin to think seriously about living better, or we are gradually going to frustrate the entire purpose for planetary existence. We can look back and see how great civilizations of the past have disappeared and left not a rack behind. We realize it is not difficult for a civilization to die. All it has to do is continue in evil ways until there is no remedy possible. Now, in this particular instance, there seems to be a very good chance that we can break the rule and that we can accomplish this renovation that is so desperately necessary. The big stumbling block is at the moment is the problem of how to make this renovation without interfering with our present attitudes in any major way. In other words, we mustn't interfere with the idea of wealth. We mustn't interfere with the idea of competition. We must do all these changes without interfering with the causes of the trouble, because these causes we have become accustomed to. It's amazing to realize that one of the biggest adjustments that humanity's made up to the present time is to become accustomed to misery, because it is everywhere. And we have to become accustomed to broken homes, to disloyal children, to corrupt governments, to natural disasters, crime. These things we have to become accustomed to. They're here, and in some mysterious way, we fear that anything will change these basic patterns. Because each little person has a conspiracy of his own that depends for its fulfillment upon some mistaken activity. He is trying to accomplish a good end by bad means, and this just simply does not work. So in finding the problem as it is, we have to say we cannot change the destiny of the world unless we overcome, at least in part, the difficulties which cause the problem. Other creatures outside of the human family are not decision makers in this great program. Nature itself runs according to its own rules. It is human nature that, endowed with individual consciousness, becomes capable of making significant mistakes. Therefore, the remedy has to rest with humanity and not the other lesser forms of life on the planet. The other forms of life are suffering also from our mistakes. What are we going to do about this? We know that we cannot go on developing a munition industry that must ultimately cause somebody to cause a great disaster. We cannot permit this continual emphasis upon armament, this continual determination not to let anybody else have much, this often overworked determination to take over somebody else's land. It's just like a person deciding to move into an apartment occupied by another family. They don't ask, they just move in. Now, the landlord isn't responsible for this, and the landlord doesn't like it. And therefore, these false moves always end in trouble. When we exploit nature's privileges, when we break nature's moral and ethical rules, we always get into trouble. We have been breaking them systematically since the beginning of history, and history is now becoming a long record of the consequences of intentional errors. Now, there are a lot of things that people do that they do not realize to be wrong. But most of the major mistakes are recognized as mistakes before they're made. We know they are wrong, but they may be profitable. They may be justified by attitudes. They may be the next step in the development of a selfish system. So we condone all kinds of troubles simply because we hope in the end something will happen advantageous to ourselves. In the end, it doesn't happen, however. So here we are in this apartment house where we have good living conditions and where we have every opportunity to do the things that are necessary. And the only answer, as the Chinese pointed out a long time ago, but were not able to make it work for themselves, the only thing that we can do that is permanent is to put our own houses in order, put our own apartment in order, and prove conclusively to the landlord that we are taking proper care of his property. There's a reward for that. It's very possible the landlord will lower the rent because he doesn't have to spend so much taking care of the damage that we cause. And the universe is like this. So we have to now begin to think of what we would do in order to get the big landlord into a better condition and a better shape and kind of mind, to make him the real parent, the lord in the castle on the top of the hill, surrounded by happy people doing the things they want to do and growing under a benevolent system of universal laws. This is what has to happen. One of the things, of course, we have to understand some way is that there are such rules, that this landlord is a real existence. It isn't an elderly gentleman who sits behind a desk in a bank or something. It is, however, a principle which we can personify. The great landlord, therefore, is actually integrity itself, the final cause of creation, and the final means of its preservation. There are certain rules that cannot be broken, and individuals trying to break these rules are always in trouble. Up to maybe 50 or 100 years ago, people were more careful about breaking rules, especially in this country. We had a comparatively civil civilization here. We had a condition in which most people, living in smaller communities, lived according to some moral or ethical code. They were churchgoers, they were friendly, they stepped in when troubles arose, they took care of sickness and difficulty in the community, and they lived a kind of quiet life. This was now considered much too boring. We've got to have something more exciting. We can't be just people anymore. But in the course of getting all this excitement worked up, we have gradually created an impossible burden. We have created a situation in which our very joys are destroying us, that we are no longer able to withstand the pressures of our own appetites. A good example of this, of course, is the present narcotic problem. There's hardly anyone who becomes involved in narcotics who doesn't know he's in trouble, or that ultimately will destroy him. But he is no longer concerned about this. It's how he feels this minute and how he fits into the peer group today. The future is beyond comprehension or beyond interest. We are all living in deadly moments. Now, this business of living only in the year of 1986 is wrong. We don't live just in one town, one time, one place. We all have a past behind us and a future ahead of us, and both are being constantly modified. the individual who believes that if he is happy today, this is all that is important, wakes up tomorrow in misery. The individual who believes that now is the only time worth living in is unable to change the values of national reorganizations of countries or incorporations of cities and towns or regulations of traffic. Everything is according to the will of the moment. And this is true particularly in the matter of wealth. We are wealthy-minded. We do not care what happens if we lose it, but we must get it. All that sounds fine in the getting, but it sounds bad in the losing. And this is what happens all the time. All the way back to the time of Plato and Aristotle, the Greeks and the Egyptians and the Hindus, the wise people realized that an abuse of privilege is the source of most downfalls in history and in personal living. We do not do the best we can with what we have. Now comes a new report. We're having very great trouble maintaining literacy in our own country. People do not even care whether they can read or write. They find that it doesn't fit into the pattern so well. What they want is not to read and write or to study for craft or art. What they want is a way of doing exactly what they please right now. Now, this isn't universally true. There are many fine students in this country. There are many fine people. But there is this tremendous wave of people who are interested only in living up the fullness of their own appetites, whatever these may be. And anything that curtails them is an abuse and a crime, and is necessary as cause for terrorism or civil war or anarchy. So we now have to try to think this through for ourselves, to try to see what we could do now to make it a little better. So we have to take each individual and tell him to look into his own portfolio and see what he has. What is he doing with what he has? Is he using it? Is he wasting it? Is he able to direct the course of his own assets in a manner consistent with natural good? Is he so wise in accumulating that he has a great deal, but so unwise in the distribution of what he has that he doesn't know what to do next? All the way along, we note that so-called security from a physical standpoint is an illusion. There is no security beyond that which integrity and intelligence and thoughtfulness can bestow upon the individual. Now, we have had the Greeks and the Egyptians and the Hindus also came to the conclusion that actually the only important political change that the average person can make is within himself. He has to decide what is right. He has to do that which he knows is next. Now, the accomplishment of right is not as difficult as it sounds. Very few people are really punished these days for being well-dispositioned or thoughtful or kindly. They are regarded with a certain amount of sympathy, tolerance, and even friendliness. But the average person does not want to become like them, because it means that he will have to sacrifice, he will have to share, he will have to work with other people, and he will have to serve causes beyond himself. The beginning of wise civilization is when people begin to serve causes above themselves, where they start doing things for the greater good rather than merely for their own personal advantage. We have to look very carefully, as the old alchemist did, at this little bottle that we are living on. It is a kind of an alchemical bottle, and it has all kinds of things in it. But there is nothing in it that can replenish itself as rapidly as we can destroy the supply. It takes many, many years, many centuries, in fact, to make changes in the great chemical structure of the earth. but it only takes a very short time for man to use up the available potentials. We know that we have to change a great many ways because we can't live with ourselves. Now we are finding that wrongness, bad living, thoughtlessness, cruelty, all these are contributing to pollution. Now, pollution is nothing but neglect of integrities. Pollution is, I don't care what happens, I want mine now. Pollution is, let's forget everything else but progress. And we now really consider pollution a symptom of progress. We think if we have enough progress, it will cure its own solutions and its own causes, but it won't. So we now believe that the only way to live is to continue to make the old mistakes until finally the cataclysm hits. In the last 10 years, this has lost a lot of its attractiveness. We are no longer so happy at that prospect. We are no longer so eager to see ourselves move into the ultimate state of our present condition. So all over the world, here, everywhere else, voices are being raised. Groups of people are rising against war. Others are rising against tyrannies of all kinds. They are rising against corruption in government, in law, in medicine, in everything. What they are really rising against or trying to is self-centeredness. They are trying to rise above the self-centered ambitions of certain small groups, minority groups of the people. They can do it, but it means that they have to start in disciplining their own integrities. The final answer to this particular subject addressed strictly in the terms of Lord Bacon, namely, that it begins by the public, the people themselves, demanding an improvement in world conditions. It comes because each quiet citizen is beginning to realize that the civilization he has belonged to is eroding under his feet. He is beginning to realize that he is on a toboggan that is leading to chaos. This is beginning to filter through to all levels of people. We have great admiration for science, and many people do respect it now. But we had a tremendous respect for it when it began to give us the necessary vaccines against infantile paralysis or to help us with the curing of rabies and things of this nature. We also found out that it gave us electric lights and it gave us all kinds of conveniences, and it has gone on and on and on until it has given us the ultimate inconvenience, and that is the computer. We are now in this type of situation that we really admired science. We began to really regard the scientist as an adequate substitute for the priest of antiquity. The scientist was the new philosopher, the new mystic, the new evangelist of all things good and desirable. Then all of a sudden, this great scientist, scientific world, gave us the bomb. In that one moment, our faith in progress on a material nature received a death wound. We found that the greater skill we have adds to our misery unless we can control our own skill, and we haven't been able to do so. So here we are, deprived of the leadership of that phase of knowledge which promised to lift us into infinite happiness, peace, and security. We now know that it is leading us towards an incredible disaster. But having lost the face of scientific progress, we began to look around a little bit for philosophical progress. And we found that we didn't have much luck. If we wanted any philosophy worthwhile, we had to drop back several hundred years to a more golden age of thinking, when the individual had the leisure and the incentives to analyze his own life and the life of the society to which he belonged. Modern philosophy has been very sterile and unproductive in its contributions to life. Then we turn to religion. Here we find solid religions that have stood all over the world for centuries. And they have unquestionably been the greatest single cause of good that we have had in society. But they also have had their limitations. They have been unable to reach the core of the disaster, and that is the nature of the believer himself. We have all kinds of religions that say, thou shalt not kill. And we have killing in every color, race, and belief there is. We are told to love one another and go to church to believe this and then turn around and exploit one another. We are talking about religion. We are not living it. We are talking about integrities, and we honor the saints long dead who had them. But we are not doing it ourselves. We do not believe that when we read in the scripture, thou shalt love one another, that this is intended for us. Why should we love anybody when yet we consider ourselves religious people? We also have our allegiances in other areas. In every area, however, we have theories that are good, we have concepts that are useful, and practices that are not. So we now have to face the very simple problem of changing this particular problem and realizing truly that the voice of the people is the voice of God. And the voice of the people is a more or less of a whimper at the moment in most parts of the world. Most people are sending up cries and wails of sorrow, misery, and pain. And this in itself must have a very deep effect upon the laws of nature, because there isn't a single law in nature that was created to cause hate. There isn't a single law in nature that was intended to demonstrate the importance of dishonesty. All of these corruptions have arisen within people who have disobeyed the law, distorted them, falsely interpreted them, or ignored them completely. So the time is now, and we see in the last 5 or 10 years, a tremendous upsurge. There is an upsurge in religion, but it is not limited entirely to the traditional forms. For these traditional forms are very largely involved in the very mistakes that they are supposed to be healing. The religions themselves have to have a more or less definite renovation. They have to get back to the principles upon which they were built, and they must divide peoples into two groups: a religious person who keeps the rules, and a member of something who simply breaks them. This difference is becoming very vital and important. So with the proper understanding of a new idea of what constitutes a spiritual integrity, we can have considerable progress. Now, it has been a notable phenomenon for thousands of years that religions have been strongly renovated in times of great emergency. And while people drifted along very largely doing as they pleased, religions were a luxury. But when things get really bad, religion becomes a necessity. And in this particular case, it is coming that way at the moment. Also, the individual looking around him has great difficulty in finding a religion that actually satisfies him. Now, this is not as real a problem as it seems to be, because he is judging the religion by the followers, not by the principles of the faith itself.